One of my online listeners just had a point from last time that I forgot to mention, which is extremely important, which is that we're talking about writing Lishma, that before you make any corrections in Sefer Torah, you have to preferably say L'Shem Kedusha Sefer Torah. So when you're working on a Shem, anything that's Shem Hashem, any variation thereof, then you have to say, not only are you doing it L'Shem Kedusha Sefer Torah, but you're doing L'Shem Kedusha Hashem also. And again, b'di'evit, if you knew you were working on the Shem and you had in mind for that, so then it would be good. But l'chatchila, you should definitely try to express that sentiment orally and not rely simply on thinking it. So before we get to continue the Aleph Beis, we're going to talk a little bit about tefillin and mezuzahs, but it's a completely different angle because when we talk about Sefer Torah, you're going to be looking at them on the inside, where the writing actually is. And for the most part, when your congregants come to you with questions about the tefillin and mezuzahs, it's going to be looking at it from the outside only, without having actually to deal with the inside, which should definitely be left to a professional sofer. The first question that a lot of times you're going to get from your balabatim is, Rabbi, are my tefillin sufficiently square? So they know that tefillin, the halacha and loshem yisina, have to be square. So what does that mean? It means the base part, excluding the part where the ritzua goes through, this whole base has to be square, as well as the batim themselves and the stitching around where the batim are sewn together. So a lot of people like to come with calipers and specialized electronic equipment to try to measure exactly how square these features of the batim are, but according to halacha, that's really not necessary. As long as it appears to the untrained eye to be square, looking at a normal distance, you know, you don't keep looking at it closely and see if you can try to find the slightest thing off with it. That's if it looks square, it's square, and we shouldn't worry about that too much. There is a machlokas, which relates to something that you might occasionally be asked about, which is, we know that the base of the batim, let's say in the shel rosh, you have not one compartment, but of course, you know, you have four different compartments, each with a separate parcha of tefillin in it. So ideally, the four compartments of the shel rosh are supposed to be what we call prudis. They're supposed to be completely separate without any glue in between whatsoever. You should be able to, in theory, take a knife or a string or something like that and take it between each compartment from the top all the way down to the bottom. Now, b'di'evit, if it's not completely separate, as long as it's at least a little separate on the top, at least preferably mostly separate, whatever it is, it's still good. But nevertheless, because people try to be mahadir about the issue of the prudis, that the four batim of the shel rosh come apart, so a lot of times you're going to have them lose their perfect squareness, as you might see in this parrot tefillin, for example, their four batim are separate, nevertheless, they remain perfectly square. So in this one, it's not so bad, but in this one, for example, you'll see that since there's no glue in between the batim, so they start to spread a little bit. So the Chassam Sofer was machmir on this. They held that they had to look completely square together, so this bias would potentially perhaps be puzzle. However, there are diukim in the Rishonim, statements in the Rishonim that are explicitly against that the four batim of the Shorosh don't have to actually be square when at the time that you're actually looking at them, as long as you would put them together, for example, you'd squeeze them together, they'd be square, then it would be okay. So ideally, we try to be machmir for the Chassam Sofer, but if anything about the tefillin are not perfectly square, then we would prefer it to be that which I just described, that the batim are not completely perfectly pressed together.
A common question that comes up with this is if somebody bangs tefillin,
yeah,
and on the corner, it appears to be a bit of a chip or something like that that has affected the square.
It's also very common. So you say you're diving too close to the wall and you smack your tefillin against the wall. And so one of these corners gets dulled. So that is probably not a problem. As long as bechlalius, the tefillin basically looks square, that is probably okay, even if the corner is dulled. If you whack these heavy-duty tefillin that we have nowadays against the wall 10 times, it's probably going to be more square than they were in the times of the Tanoim when they were, you know, they had much less technology of how to make the tefillin exactly square. But nevertheless, we try to be makbid as much as possible to have the corners be somewhat sharp and to try to have the corners appear to be square as well. That happens to be one of the easiest things to fix about tefillin, and you could probably do it at home yourself. You basically take, the skin of the batim is not fully tanned. So that means that if you apply water to it, so it's going to puff up, and it's going to change shape. So what you do is you take a Q-tip, you wet the Q-tip, you let it sit against the corner for a little while till the corner puffs up, and it's going to puff up beyond its original boundaries. Then you sand it down to make it square. Very, very easy. Don't be scared of doing it. Try to get a puzzle peritone to practice on. Perhaps it's really extremely easy to fix that yourself. You don't need a professional sofer to do that. But a lot of times people will be more comfortable with a professional sofer.
But at what point, if you see that chip or dulling, at what point do you have to be concerned?
If it starts to look not square. If you want to, even with the slightest chip, if you want to try to fix it, okay, lechatchila, why not? But I personally would not consider a puzzle unless it was looked very obviously not square. Another very common question that comes up both to rabbis and sofrim, where people really start, we find this very, sofrim find this very humorous, that people come and say, sofer, rabbi, or whatever, I think my tefillin have a serious problem with them. So what's the serious problem? I have to look a little bit more closely. I can see a crack here. I can see a crack here between what we call the titura tachtona and the titura elyona, where obviously that's opened up, the parshas are put in, then the tefillin are sewn together. So I can see a crack there, what's wrong with my tefillin, are they fussel, what's going on over here? So whenever someone asks me that question, I say, shkoyach, your tefillin are actually more mehudar than any tefillin where you cannot see the crack. What's the reason for that? Because there's a machlokes between the Mishnah Berurah and the Chazon Ish. Basically, the halacha of Moshe Mesinai is that tefillin have to be held together by gidim, by the stitching that tefillin were held together with for thousands of years without any glue. So the Mishnah Berurah is makel that after you finish the stitching, if you put in a little glue into the between this crack here between the titura aliona and the titura tachtona, so that's okay. Since originally you closed it by stitching, a little glue afterwards is not a problem. The Chazon Ish said nothing doing. The glue is now mevatel the tviros. Then now that it's not the stitching that's holding the tefillin together. If you remove the stitching, you couldn't pull the tefillin apart. It's just the glue that's holding it together. So that's a problem. It's done. The glue is put in basically to make the tefillin look nicer. So that if you put in glue and then these two parts are stuck together forever, and then you paint over here, so the tefillin, that whole titura, you see no crack here, it's all one nice, beautiful, black paint job. But the truth is that there's really no reason to do that. With our heavy-duty tefillin, gasos tefillin that we have nowadays, nothing's going to happen to them. Could be the titura could warp a little bit, which could potentially compromise the ribua, the squareness. But usually not so much to seriously compromise it. Nevertheless, the al pi halacha, it certainly is better not to have any glue in the titura whatsoever. So if you care more about halacha than you do about how gorgeous your tefillin looks, so it's good to recommend to your congregants or for yourself or whatever not to get any glue in the titura. There's really no reason to do that besides for looks. And certainly if there was glue and the glue starts to come apart and you can start seeing the crack there, there's absolutely nothing to be concerned about. It's perfectly fine and, like I said, potentially halachically even better. Someone asked me, first we'll talk about the blackness. Another issue that comes up is the blackness of the ritzuis and the blackness of the batim. So the blackness of the ritzuis, it says explicitly in the Gemara, that's halacha Moshe Mesinai, that the ritzuis have to be black. So what happens if the paint of the ritzuis starts chipping or cracking and you have to fix it? So the arshitas that hold rubo kechulo, that if it's mostly black, so it's considered black, but the Mishnah Berurah doesn't love this. So they try to be machmir that the ritzuis should be completely 100% black, but they sell handy markers with a hechsher to paint the ritzuis with, so that's really should not be too difficult to fix. But if it's just a tiny bit of black that's missing, especially after the cheer of where the ritzuis really needs to finish, so temporarily, if somebody can't get paint, so then it shouldn't be such a big deal. And emergency, we try to be, the reason that the paint should have extra is because, like I said before about the ink, that it really should be min hamutar b'ficha, that the poskim are machmir, that every part of the tefillin should be made of kosher ingredients. But if you absolutely cannot get anything besides that, so then the arshit is that the paint does not need to be min hamutar b'ficha. Yeah.
When we say min hamutar b'ficha, so does that mean it has to be not non-kosher, or it has to be...
You mean made from cow?
Right, like, what it just has to not...
Well, no, the batim have to be made from a kosher animal. The parshi, the klaf, and the ritzu is also made from the skin of a kosher animal. But other than that, it just can't have any non-kosher ingredients.
If it's not edible at all, would that theoretically not apply? I mean, you can't eat the paint, I assume.
Well, the batim are also not edible. They're just skin that are soaked in lime. So you wouldn't eat that anyway. But still, the part of the nature of the beast is that it has to have the ingredients from a kosher source. Obviously, if you ate batim paint that was not kosher, so you wouldn't be chayav whatever the for malchus whatever. Maybe it would be us because of achshavei whatever. But it wouldn't be. But that would not be. It has nothing to do with that per se. Again, the Arshita is that it doesn't have to be for the paint, but we try to be machmir to get something with the hechsher so you don't have any problems. The batim are somewhat more lenient because, although there is one sheet in Rishonim, but I believe that of the Mordechai, that the Vilna Gaon Paskins like, that even the batim halacha l'moshe misinai have to be black. Nevertheless, the Shulchan Aruch and most Rishonim Paskin that the batim technically don't have to be black. Everybody agrees they're supposed to be black because of noy. It looks better. But if the paint of the batim is chipping, then it is much less of a concern than if the paint of the ritzuas is in fact chipping.
You can use the same marker though for the.
You could, yeah. There is sometimes people use shinier paint for the ritzuas and duller paint for the more matte paint for the batim. But in theory, you could use the same. Yeah. Somebody, a couple of people asked me actually before this year how frequently they should counsel congregants to get their tefillin checked. So the Shulchan Aruch paskins like the Rambam, who paskins like it's a different girsos in the Gemara, whether it's Hillel Azakein or Shammai Azakein, who says that basically he's wearing his grandfather's tefillin, the implication being he never got them checked. Once tefillin are, you know, properly stored in their batim, so you never ever have to get your tefillin checked. That's the way we paskin make our adin. There are shittas that hold you should get your tefillin checked more frequently. Some say the same as a mezuzah twice in every 7 years. Nevertheless, we don't really paskin like that. We really paskin that you never ever have to get your tefillin checked technically. Nevertheless, some people nowadays generally do like to get their tefillin checked occasionally, and the reason for that is very simple. Remember we discussed last time about the ink, that the ink nowadays is much more shvach than it was in the times of the Gemara. So even though the Chazal seemed to indicate that really you might not need to get your tefillin checked, nevertheless, nowadays, we try to get our tefillin checked with in a certain, every once in a while, not necessarily twice in every 7 years, but once every, I don't know, 10, 20, however many years. It's not, there's no specific halachic number on it, according to most shitas, just every once in a while to make sure that the paint is, that the ink isn't cracking or turning brownish or reddish, because we'd be more machmir about the turning brownish in tefillin than we are in Sefer Torah, because this is a real mitzvah d'oraisa. Sefer Torah, lemaisa, the kriya, the laning of a Sefer Torah is only derabanan, so we're more makel on the turning of the rusting of the ink. So that's one reason that even though, you know, some people will say, what, people are so firm nowadays, you have to get your people are getting their tefillin checked all the time. It says in Shulchan Aruch, you never have to get your tefillin checked. So that attitude is not necessarily correct because of the issues with the ink and the cloth being different nowadays than they were in the times of the Gemara.
So you think that they should check them more often?
I think if you have tefillin that are written with normal with the ink and the cloth that is normally used nowadays for stam, then yes, you get your tefillin checked from once in a while. I don't think again no specific number on the time, but every once in a while when you get around to it, you should get your tefillin checked. Again, also, if you get them checked, you know, a few years, you know, 10 years after your bar mitzvah, and the sofer tells you, "Wow, these tefillin are in fantastic condition," so it's very unlikely anything's going to happen to them so quickly. So you can wait another 30 years. I mean, I don't know, whatever. I'm throwing out numbers here. Yeah.
When is nowadays for the ink? Meaning, why do you have
my last several hundred years?
Last several hundred. Okay.
Yeah. So. Maybe 1,000. Any tefillin that you have this problem, unless you know for sure that you ordered them with longer lasting inks and or cloth. So Rabbi Turk made a explicit request that we should learn how to adjust ritzuos, because that's another thing that's very common, that you're a Baal Batim, we're going to come to you, that someone told them, you know, their Shel Rosh is all the way down here, and somebody told them really should tighten it, but he doesn't know how to tighten his tefillin Shel Rosh knot. So, as you may know, there are two commonly practiced, there are more, but two commonly practiced versions of what the tefillin shel rosh knot looks like. One is this, where the knot basically looks like a square, box stitch. And one is this, where the knot looks like a yud. Nobody got me?
No.
I meant a dalet, but you'll see why I said yud in a second. I'm being facetious. So, if you... we may know here in YU, just a little bit of background about the knots, We know here in YU that Rav Soloveitchik was famous for telling everyone that they should stick with their father's minag, except for two areas. Eating in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres, so you have to eat there even if your father or family, whatever, not eating the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres. And if you have this knot that looks like a square, you have to change to this knot that looks like a dalet, because the Gemara says that Halacha Moshe Sinai, that according to one Gersa, that Halacha Moshe Sinai, the knot of Tefillin Shel Rosh has to look like a dalet. So you have, according to Rav Soloveitchik, you have to, and some other poskim, if you have this knot, you have to switch to this knot. There's only one problem with that, however, which is that the Rishonim, many sets of Rishonim, some of which are brought in the Beis Yosef and Simon Lamed Beis, give explicit step-by-step instructions on how to construct the knot of the Tefillin Shel Rosh. And guess what, Rav Osai? Every single one of them, it comes out like this. Like the square. So that's what all of Klal Yisrael was doing for thousands of years before this knot got invented, which was probably sometime in the last 300 years or so by a certain group of Mikubalim. Nevertheless, the actual traditional knot that was Nohog in all the Jewish people, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, Taimanim, everywhere, was actually the one that looks like a square. So how is this a Dalid? Pashup Shad is because if you look at the Ritzuas combined with the knot, it sort of looks like a Dalid. Maybe we can try to work on figure out exactly why this was called a Dalid more, but nevertheless, this was certainly the case. And if you don't believe me, or you don't have time to look at the instructions step by step on how to make the knots that I brought in the Rishonim, so I can tell you something very easy, which is that the Rishonim say that the Kesher Shel Rosh had a slight modification over the course of the centuries of how it was made, because on the back of the Shel Rosh knot, if you do it the original way, it looks like a cross. And we don't want crosses on our tefillin, so therefore they made a slight modification. We made it look not like a cross. So, I have here one example of the original way that the Kesher Shel Rosh was made. On the back is a cross. On the back of the dalet knot, nothing even closely resembling a cross in any way, shape, or form. So therefore, that's another clear-cut proof that this, in fact, is the original Kesher. Taimanim still have it this way, because they didn't have Christians in Yemen, so they didn't have such negative associations with cross per se. Nevertheless, so if you parrot Rav Soloveitchik's psak and tell any of your balabatim to switch from the this kesher, the square, to the dalet, so that would not be I would not highly not recommend that. In any event, the original knot, the square. They should know also, by the way, it's a machlokes rishonim, whether you need the exact surah of the kesher that HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai, or any kesher is good enough, especially if it sort of is merames to a dalet, like this one is. Even though you could argue that it looks like a yod, but okay. So it's not like you're for sure not yotzei tefillin if you have this knot. We don't like to say that about all the good Jews nowadays who have this knot. But nevertheless, if it certainly is your minhag to do this, definitely should not switch. So this knot also happens to be much easier to adjust. As you might know, if you did lanyards, so this knot appears very frequently in that as well. Basically, I'll pass these around so you can play with it as we continue the rest of our program. But basically, this thing, this knot on the ritzua on the right side, and on the left side, depending on how you look at it, continues this one right here. So basically, you pull one side up, and then you continue it like that, and then you pull it up like that if you wanna make it bigger. And same, you pull this down, and then you just follow the ritsua and keep going like that if you want to make it smaller. Okay, you can find guidebooks that explain exactly how to do it, but that's more or less the way. So I could pass it around if you wanna experiment with it. And So here's the original. This is the original way with brush in the back. Yeah.
Do you even have like any kind of kavana when you're doing it? Or?
You have to say the same thing just going. But again, if you forgot to say it, so then it wouldn't be a problem because obviously you know you're doing it for the sake of filling. So this is the dalet knot, the so-called dalet knot, as opposed to the square. This is much, much harder to adjust. Much, much harder. Basically, you only work with facing. If you're looking at the kesher, you only work with the right side. So if you want to, this on the bottom on the right is a continuation of this on the top on the right. So you pull this down, you follow the Ritzua, basically. You can pull this up to give you some more slack, and you can pull that up and then pull down to make it smaller, and then you do the opposite, pull that up and pull it down to make it bigger.
I think I messed it up.
It certainly looks that way. Here. Whatever it is. Pass it around. And these are just some shell yad knots. These are not going to... If anything happens, you have to retie them. There's no adjusting. You don't really need to adjust them because they don't fit you. In other words, the ritzua slides back and forth in the loop. This is so-called Svar, this is so-called Ashkenaz, and there's really no adjusting necessary, so if anything happens to these, you basically have to take it to a sofer to retie. But I'm just passing it around for you to look at.
It's a good technique to have to be able to adjust the shel rosh, because if you're, you know, out, you don't want to have to, the person really may not be yotzei tefillin, depending on how badly it's fitting, and if you have no sofa where you are, you know, it really could be a problem. So it really is a good technique to have.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you can look at on YouTube. You can look in books.
What? This needs to be sent around, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
The reason why the box style of knot wasn't continued was because it looked too much like a cross.
No. There was a slight modification made to it at a certain point. I don't know, 600 years ago or something, because in order to avoid the cross on the back, but the front still looks the same. Yeah.
You will. It's very likely that you'll have someone in your shul that is wearing tefillin shel rosh that really is not fitting and is wearing it in a place where he's not yotzei. So it's a little bit of an uncomfortable thing to approach the person, especially if it's been going on for a long time, but.
Where they're 95 years old.
Right. But you really have to, because they really, sometimes it's a real problem. Mm-hmm. Especially with older people.
Also, the Bar Mitzvah boys, they always,
right.
They need adjusting on their
time. Right. Right. But with Bar Mitzvah boys, the father and the Bar Mitzvah boy are happy to have the correction. With older people, especially, people that are much, much older than you, don't appreciate the correction. So you have to be very delicate about these things.
So mezuzahs, again, is not as much. It's not certainly not as complicated as tefillin. Oh, one more thing about the tefillin: that the Zohar says that the yud, this yud. Remember there's a shin on the bayis, then the back of the tefillin shel rosh is a dalad, then there's a yud on the tefillin shel yad. So the Zohar says that the yud of the tefillin shel yad has to be touching the bias. So a lot of times, so what Sofrim doing nowadays, they started this new shtick that they actually tie it to the bias, so you shouldn't have any problems when you're putting it on. It shouldn't be hard to get the yud to touch the bias. So a lot of times this snaps, so people will come to you and say, Rabbi, I'm not yotzei tefillin, I have this, my yud isn't touching the bias, I can't get it to stick. That's also not true. That's al pi kabbalah, but according to halacha, that's actually not a requirement at all. We try to be makbid on it. It's actually brought in the Shulchan Aruch. But it's not like you're not yotzei tefillin if the yod does not touch the bias. So in terms of mezuzahs, Chazal tell us that we have to check mezuzahs twice in 7 years, at least for a private mezuzah in a private home. The question arises nowadays. So let's say you have your mezuzah wrapped in saran wrap and plastic wrap. Or you have your mezuzah written in Diola Netzach, which I mentioned last time, which is never supposed to have anything happen to it to make the mezuzah puzzled. You still have to check it twice in 7 years. So that's the difference of agreement between the poskim. Most poskim assume that you still need to check it twice in every 7 years. It's an absolute halacha instituted by Chazal, but that's left to your rabbinical judgment, what you want to tell your balabatim if you feel that there's not a reason to check mezuzahs twice in every 7 years if they're hermetically sealed or otherwise preserved in a way that would not be known to Chazal. Rudimentary checking skills that if a Baal HaBayis comes to you and shows you a mezuzah and it's obviously cracking or something like that, then you would recommend that he see a sofer even if it's not exactly the time that the mezuzah is supposed to be checked. When you roll it back up, so you roll it from end to beginning, it's the way Chazal phrases, me'echad kelapei shma. So as if when you open the mezuzah, tefillin parshiyos are also rolled up this way, by the way, that basically when you open it up, you can start reading it starting from Shema. So it has to be right side up on the doorway. Again, these are all things that you should know Again, we're not going into exactly where you have to affix the mezuzahs. That's, I believe, in contemporary halacha discussed. Fine. So I think we're pretty...
In terms of wrapping what? It into the saran wrap, is there anything, yeah. anything special to know? Just roll it in. Is it
usually the sofer will do it for you. It's one of my least favorite activities as a sofer, trying to get it into the saran wrap. I much prefer the exciting stuff like cracking open the tefillin and checking the brushes. But yeah, if you need to do it yourself, so just roll it up as tight as you can and put it in saran wrap. And you can roll it loose if it'll fit in the case. There's no halacha that has to be rolled tight per se. So I think we can now go back to the alphabet unless there are more questions about tefillin and mezuzahs. It's just to protect it from getting rubbed against your clothes or, you know, if you're wearing your sleeve over it. So it shouldn't dull the corners.
You mentioned before, but something important out to me that sometimes they block the yin from touching this.
Well, that's already a big chumrah. That the Zohar means that you shouldn't, that the yud has to be touching the bias all the time, even when you're not wearing it. It's already a big chumrah.
Okay.
It's not the end of all, yeah? I mentioned it very briefly, yeah. We could talk more about that afterwards. So, okay, back to the alphabet. I believe we're on Tess. So, Tess, the major issue with Tess is that if it's separated, if you have a crack in a Tess, it could look like... It could look like a chaf and a zayin, or potentially a nun and a zayin. So you have to make sure that one of the more important letters to make sure the two parts are actually touching is in fact a tess. And if you had a little crack over here, then you would have to, and it still basically looked like a tess, then you would be subject to a shailas tinuk, like we discussed before. Yud. Yud is a very interesting letter because it's subject to a lot of discussion. It's a very tiny letter, but the poskim like to rip on it a lot. The Gemara, one of the examples, the Mishnah says in Menachos that even ksav echad me'akvan, that even if any part of the tefillin is gone, then the tefillin are puzzles. The Gemara debates what that means. So it says even kutzo shel yud, even if the tefillin are missing, one of the kutzim of the yud. So what does it mean, kutzo shel yud? So that's the machlokes rishonim. That here is a properly written modern Ashkenazi yud. Looks something like that. So you have Rashi holds that that's the kutzel shel yud, the bottom part like over there. So basically, according to Rashi, if the yud is just written like this, and then many other Rishonim as well, probably the Rambam, the Meiri, if the yud is just written like this, then it's perfectly kosher. According to Rabbeinu Tam, he holds no. It's talking about these tiny little things on the left side. Some say Rabbeinu Tam holds it's this thing on the top, and some say Rabbeinu Tam holds it's this little kutz on the bottom. So the poskim generally are much more machmir about the kutz on the bottom for some reason, even though the Machzor Vitri says in the name of Rabbeinu Tam that it's the thing on the top. But nevertheless, we try to be machbid that a yud should have all these three parts, in addition to the main body of the yud, that's supposed to have a little kutz on top, a little kutz on bottom, and of course the regal, that if we're missing this, then it'll be completely a puzzle. There is nothing to talk about. So a lot of times you'll find that, especially in older Sifrei Torah, especially in Sephardi Sifrei Torah, so this will be missing. It won't have that little kutz tachton, as it's called, coming down. If the whole Sefer Torah is missing the Kutz Tachton, then it's probably going to be extremely expensive and not worth it to hire a sofer to go through the whole Sefer Torah and fix it to put those little things back on the Yud. So we just rely on the Shitas that you don't need a Kutz Tachton. You can use the Sefer Torah to read on Shabbos. And if it's an old Sfardi, especially in Sfardim, some Ashkenazim too, they wrote Lechatfila in Morocco and Yemen and other places. They wrote Lechatfila without this Kutz on the bottom because they passed like either this Shita or this Shita. So I would cringe if I saw a Sefer Torah that was written by a super frum, pious Moroccan scribe 800 years ago, and he wrote a yud like this, and some modern sofer went through the entire Sefer Torah, going each and every yud, and going like that little thing at the bottom. They leave old Sfarim, if they were supposed to be written that way, written that way. But nevertheless, in normal Ashkenazi contemporary psak, we try to be makbid for all these three things, yeah?
So what did Meiri say again?
As long as it has this, so it's okay. In other words, if the yud just looks like this, as long as it has the body and the regal, then it's okay, yeah?
Okay.
And something like a mezuzah, is that something you could fix by...
Yeah, so we mentioned last time that in contrast to Sefer Torah, so the Shulchan Aruch says that for tefillin and mezuzahs, they have to be written kesidron, each letter has to be written in order. So if you have, again, it's not going to come up, you're going to be working with Sefer Torah and Megillas and stuff like that more, but in case you're not, you're looking at a mezuzah, and it happens to be, let's say all the, it's written in a style that's really supposed to have this kutz on the bottom, and one of several of the yudim, or one of the yudim happens to be missing that kutz, so you could still fix it, because basically the tzura of the yud is there, and it's just adding an extra level of halachic correctness to the yud, so it's not considered to be, now you're writing the yud anew, so it would not be considered to be a problem of shul gezidron. But a yud, and other problems with yud that are more serious than the kutzim are, that if the regal is too long, it could look like a vav. If this part is too wide, it could look like a resh, a tiny little resh. If the kutz tachton is too long, what do you got? A ches. A lot of times you have serious issues that a yud will mamish look like a little ches instead of a yud. So you have to be very careful that the kutz tachton does not go too long. If the kutz elyon is too big, what have you got? A lamed. So a yud is one of the letters that's most easily becomes fussel. You think in your normal printed Hebrew font that it's such an innocuous little letter, but in stam it really causes a lot of headache. After the yud comes chaf, the main issue of the chaf, it could be too square, it could look like a base. When it comes to a final chaf, so you have a final chaf, a lot of times you'll have a problem that it's too short, and it will look like a rish. So that would be subject ordinarily to Shilas Tinok, that if the Tinok can recognize this as an endochaf instead of a resh, then you are good to go. But ideally it should be well longer, that you shouldn't have any problems whatsoever. As in theory, if it's too square over here, it could look like a dalet, but in general it'll be long enough that there won't be an issue. And so many old styles of handwriting, they actually made a lechatchila like this square on the top, but nowadays the poskim generally recommend on the pattern of a regular chaf, which is certainly rounded, so that you should try to make the letter, you should try to make the end of chaf round on top, and that's the general tzura that we try to give an end of chaf lechatchila. After that comes lamed. So the problems with the lamed would be as follows. This is the way a lamed is really supposed to look, more or less. This is what I think a lamed is supposed to look. A lot of times, actually, in normal Ashkenazi ksav, it's actually more like this. More like that. For the reason that, again, as I told you, that these mystical svarim that try to give the Kabbalistic secrets of the letters, they say that a lamed is composed of a chaf with a vav on top. So what does that mean? If a lamed is really supposed to look like this, so it means this looks sort of like a chaf, this looks sort of like a vav, we can say it has Kabbalistic secrets. But the contemporary Sofrim took it, so actually I would say more in the last couple hundred years ago, they took it very, very literally, started making a lamed looking like this. Literally a chaf with a vav on top. So the Vilna Gaon was reported to have said that this is puzzle, that if the bottom is all the way drawn to the left side, then that's a puzzle, but a lot of old Sifrei Torah, it actually looks like that. So the way we paskin is, it looks like a lamed, nobody's going to confuse it actually with a chaf, or like a chaf with a little tag on top. So therefore, you'd certainly not put back a Sifrei Torah like that. If you're ordering a new Sifrei Torah, or you're ordering a new stam of any kind, so you should make sure that the lamed doesn't go all the way to the bottom. And I think that bechlal is not supposed to look like a chaf on bottom, it's just supposed to look like that, with an angled regal, yeah?
The Tinok says, that's a Zion in script. Like,
it's a chaf on Doesn't count. That's why you have to test him to make sure he's familiar. Before, it's advisable to test him to make sure, in other letters, to make sure he can really recognize the Ksav of the Sefer Torah. So something that's also b'dievet is if this doesn't look like a Vav, that if this is short like a Yud, that's also b'dievet, but you wouldn't take out a Sefer Torah, a new Sefer Torah for it, but it should be fixed after Shabbos. Same thing, if this is missing, if it doesn't have a little flaggy thing on the top, and it's just the top of the lamed is a straight line, same thing, you don't take out a new Sefer Torah Shabbos, but it should be fixed as soon as possible after Shabbos.
So there's a break between the chaf and the vav.
So if it... In other words, if you have a lama that's written the correct way, which looks something like that, then if you have a little break there, then that's not going to be, whoops, that's not going to be an issue because it doesn't look like anything. It couldn't possibly be anything but a lama. Again, the top part maybe, it's true, the top part really does look like a vav. That's a good question.
The Shailas Tinok, or you have to just...
I would say it's a Shailas Tinok, yeah. If he can see that these two are really supposed to be connected and that's supposed to be a lamed, then it would be okay. Again, if it really looks like a vav on top, and you can read it independently as a vav, then maybe their Biposki will be machmir, but another sniff lahokil would be the fact that this is above the lines. Let's say you have a mem in front of this, so this vav is not in the line. So it obviously can't really be a vav, it's basically it's on top of something like this. Could be a suspended vav, but that's another reason that maybe this case is not so severe. But if you have something that looks like this, if you have a chaf, if a lama that's written in the style from 100 years ago, 200 years ago, that a mamash looks like a chaf, and then you have a little thing on like that, and it's separated, and the tinok says chaf, then you have a serious problem. Then you have to put back the sefer Torah, even on Shabbos, that would be completely puzzle. Mem. Again, we talked about how it could look like a chaf and a vav. That would be a problem. Another problem is sometimes that the nose thingy is too long. So if you have this, that's not so good. If it still looks like a mem, then you're not put back a new Sefer Torah on Shabbos, but those things should definitely be fixed. A final mem is more of a problem, because a final mem could look like a samech very easily. That is supposed to be, at least on the bottom, it's supposed to be completely square. Have the sharp corners over here, so it's clear to everyone that it has nothing to do with the samech. But a lot of times, especially if you're writing quickly, so you're writing quick strokes, so this is not going to have necessarily the sharpest corner, so if you have something where it's a little bit rounded over here, so it could easily be a shailas tinok for a samech, if you find something that in a sefer Torah, you have to certainly ask a shailas tinok.
What do you do if there's no tinok?
There's some poskim who are have an interesting creative solution to the problem if you don't have a tinok, which is you ask a shelas godol. What's a shelas godol? He can just read the word. He knows what it's supposed to be. So how can you ask a shelas godol? It means you cover all the other letters besides the one that you have the question about, so you can't possibly recognize where it's from, and you ask a random person to come in and look at the letter and see what it is. So some poskim have such an etza. Other poskim say there's no such institution. The only institution that Chazal give us is a shelas tinok. There's no such thing as a shelas gadol. But in an emergency situation, you have no choice. You ask a shelas gadol, or you put back the sefer Torah. Yeah.
Everyone has chumashim, and if you stop on the word and go,
take someone from another minyan. Shmi zocha to be rabbis of a shul with five minyanim Shabbos morning, lots of people. It shouldn't be a problem. Yeah. Nun can easily. You'd be surprised how much this is the case. A nun could look like a base. How so? You make the bottom too short. You put it sticking all the way over on the right side, that the regal comes out like that. A tinok might easily read this as a base. Obviously, the real tzura of a nun is supposed to look like this. At least it's supposed to come out from the middle, at least in Ashkenazi, contemporary Ashkenazi Zav, or somewhere in this area, but not all the way to the right side, and you might easily come into a situation where it looks like a base. A lot of times in the old Sephardi Ksavim, and sometimes you'll find it in sloppy, even contemporary Ashkenazi Ksavim, that the top of the nun just looks like this. It looks like colloquially called a vav. So again, that's not ideal, but you would certainly not take out a new Sefer Torah for such a thing on Shabbos. For the final nun, again, you have the problem we discussed last time, which is that in the ksav of a Sefer Torah, that a final nun looks exactly the same as a zayin, it's only longer. So if you sometimes you'll have a word like this. What do you say about this? Everybody knows that the letter pei is longer than most other letters. That happens all the time. This word appears in the mezuzah. Oops. Have it like this. You have that. What does that say?
Paz.
Looks like it said paz, right?
Yeah.
So when you have a nun next to a pei, we try to make this really long so there's no question that it could possibly look like a zion. But nevertheless, since if the zion has the proper proportions, I mean the nun, I'm sorry, has the proper proportions, that it's that the regal is three times longer than the head, then you would be okay even if it happens to be next to a pei, because lamaisa the nun had the proper proportions, even though the chatchila it should not be done like this. Samech, I said, we're trying to go fast because we're almost out of time. Samech is, again, could be the problem that is that could, it could be square and look like an endomem. In ayin, you have a very common problem in stam nowadays, which is that the ayin looks like this. And you're going to tell me in a second why this is wrong. This rebosai is not an ayin, even though it's claimed to be so, according by some contemporary sufferings. That this protrusion here will be so tiny that it's very unclear as to whether this letter is in fact a tess or an ayin. Of course, a tess ideally is supposed to curve in like that, and then you wouldn't have any question, that wouldn't look like an ayin. But nevertheless, but the evidence could be kosher as a tess even like that, and therefore that would certainly be a subject to a shailas tinok. That ayins get passed all the time by tinokos nowadays due to that problem. So when I write my stam, I mean, I don't write with my own handwriting that much, but I make an ayin, not that exaggerated, but I try to draw it out very much. That should be absolutely no shayla, that it looks like, that it should look like it does. If the two heads of the ayin are touching, then, let's say it looks like this. You have the ayin, then you have that. If the two heads are touching with just a little, they just touch each other a little bit like that, so some, in the sheet of some Rishonim, you could imagine that they would be completely mako on that. But in contemporary Pesach, we are machner on this. The Mishnah Brewer says that when it comes to tefillin and mezuzahs, that you can't completely erase the ayin and write it again. Then you're just allowed to separate them and make it kosher because you have no choice. But if you have a Sefer Torah, so really you should erase the entire ayin and write it again because of the shaila, like I said last time, of chak tochos, of creating a letter by scraping it. And here, you're really, like I said, if two letters are touching each other, then it's not a shaila of creating the, according to most postgame, it's not a shaila of creating the letters by a method of scraping, because they're two independent letters. But here it's one letter that you're being machsher by scraping, so therefore the din would be more chomer in such a situation. A pei and fei, there's not too much that can go wrong with it. Usually you're going to find those to be kosher. Also, just to clear up a misconception, what is everybody taught in elementary school about the way a pei is supposed to be written in a Sefer Torah? That it's supposed to have a bez inside. How cute. So, that's a pei, right? So, a lot of sofrim nowadays write a pei like this, and then they take their kulmasin, and they're very artistically draw like that and fill in there in order to make the inside look like beis, which is very sticky and also very wrong. That's actually not how a pei is supposed to be at all. What the poskim were talking about, either they were talking about the fact that in a regular pei, even like this, without this little thing in the middle, if you have a square thing like that, so it's square inside like a beis, or the pei used to be written in sort of an interesting way with the kulmos like that, that it would sort of look like a bez in the middle because this side would be curvy. But there's no inyan to do what sofrim nowadays do, and Ashkenazi sofrim, to fill in the pei on the right side in order to make it look like a bez inside. It's just the extra work, and you pay more for your Sefer Torah and other stam for that convenience, yeah? First of all, that could be shaila anyway in terms of Siva Sefer Torah. Forget Shabbos for a second. That you're supposed to write the Sefer Torah in the normal manner. A right he has to write with his right hand, a left he has to write with his left hand. So it's not if you write it backwards with your right hand, with your correct hand. So that's also not so pushed that would be okay. So Tzadi is also a controversial letter. I said I would discuss here the difference more between Ashkenazi and Sephardi Ksavim. And in Ashkenazi Ksav, contemporary Ashkenazi Ksav at least, Tzadi looks something like this. It looks like a nun. And it looks like a yud attached to the nun. It looks like a straight yud. regular yud, right? Yud looks like this. So in Sfardi, let's take it back. In Sfardi Ksav, the way it originally used to look, actually, is they write its tzadi like this. You have tzadi, and then this part would actually look more like a zayin that would protrude from both sides. So the way this was described in some of the early literature is that it's a backwards yud, or something of that nature. So the Hasidim, when they wanted to write their script more in accordance with the teachings of the Ari, so they decided they're going to take the Ashkenazi tzadi, and lo and behold, they're going to make, instead of a straight yud, they're going to make a backwards yud. And Sfardi Ksav nowadays also, this part of the tzadi basically looks like a backwards yud. So the Chazon Ish did not like this. He did not like the idea of a backwards yud. And he felt that Ashkenazim, at least Ashkenazim have a mesorah for doing the straight yud, it's Li'ikuva. You should not use a Sfardi Sefer Torah lechatchila. You should not use Sfardi Tefillin lechatchila for this reason. However, most poskim feel that it doesn't make the slightest difference al pi halacha whether the yud is forwards or backwards. It doesn't matter at all, and so this would not be an issue. But again, a lot of non-Hasidish Ashkenazim really are very makbit to get tefillin because of this basic idea, try to get tefillin with a straight yud. One thing that's somewhat humorous about this whole discussion is that if you look at Ashkenazi Ksavim, especially from Germany, Western Europe, in the Middle Ages, so the tzadi looks like, the tzadi has a backwards yud. Looks like this. So that wasn't Ashkenazi Mesorah as well. So again, that's why I said if you ask me, I don't think there's any difference whatsoever between the quote unquote Ksav Arizal Tzadi, which is an Ashkenazi Ksav with a backwards yud, or with the Ashkenazi Ksav with the normal Ashkenazi Ksav with a straight yud, or with a Sephardi Ksav with the backwards yud at all. Halachically, I think it's all the same because it probably all derives from the idea that the thing on the right of the tzadi used to look more like Zion, which went over on both sides as opposed to just on one side. And if you want to know, by the way, Pshat, just to help you remember this, that it's brought down that the Chassam Sofer in his personal Sefer Torah, we have it, I think, we have pictures of it, had a tzadi with a backwards yud. So why'd have a tzadi with a backwards yud? So that people want to say, oh, the Chassam Sofer used Ksav Arizal. He was masking here with the Hasidim. They used Ksav Arizal. He had a backwards yud, but that's completely not right. What's the shot that the Chassam Sofer had a backwards yud in his Sefer Torah? Chassam Sofer was from Frankfurt, Germany. Western Europe, Minag Ashkenaz, is that they had a tzadi with a backwards yud. So he wanted the Sofer there to copy his Mesorah from back home in Frankfurt. So again, it's a very Ashkenazi Mesorah as well to have a backwards yud. In my view, there's no problem whatsoever. A kuf is, the main problem that can happen with a kuf is that the top could be connected. And while the Chatchila, based on a possible, probable reading of the Gemara in Shabbos, the kuf, we normally paskin that a kuf has to be disconnected and otherwise it's bustle. Somewhat questionable in general if we would really assume that's possible or only lechatchila to do it separate, but whatever. At any event, if you find the connected kuf, then you would not have to take out a new Sefer Torah on Shabbos because there are shitas that are makshir a connected kuf even. And we also know the Gemara that talks about where there's a document where it said seifel in one part of the document and kefel in another part of the document. So the reason for that is that there was all used to be just a tiny difference between a samech and a kuf. A samech looked like this, and a kuf looked like this. So it's easy that a fly could have sat on it or something and changed the samech to a kuf, and that's the pshat in that Gemara. Again, but we try to be machmer to have the kuf be disconnected. A lot of times also in contemporary ksav, you'll find, again, part of this stream of thought in contemporary Sofrim to try to take the mystical remuzin to different letters within letters mentioned in the Rishonim to the next level, is they write like this. They write a kuf, and they write the leg of the kuf like this, because in one sefer it says, in the Alpha Besa it says, that the regal of the kuf is supposed to look like a nun, an end of nun, so they write the regal of the kuf like this. That's how it is in contemporary stam, but that's also, you should know, that's really not correct. That it just means that it's supposed to be thicker on top and then get a little thinner as it gets to the bottom, and just basically supposed to be a straight line. So So just for your general knowledge in terms of how stam is really supposed to be written. A resh could be, again, if it's too square, it could look like a dalet. If it's too narrow, it could look like a vav. If it's too long, it could look like an endachaf. All subject to a shailas tinok. Shin. If the heads of the shin are touching, it's subject to the same halacha that we discussed by the ayin and tefillin and mezuzas. You can just scrape away the connection, but in a sefer Torah, you should really erase the whole shin and rewrite it. In old Sephardi Ksavim, a lot of times the shin is flat on the bottom. It looks like this. Maybe not quite so extreme, but it looks flat on the bottom. So a lot of poskim don't like that because it sounds in the Gemara like the shin is supposed to come down to a point on the bottom as it does in modern Ashkenazi Ksav. And modern Sephardi Ksav anyway is not even prevalent, even according to that opinion, because they started doing it's sort of like this, but on an angle, that it should basically come to a point on the left side, so any contemporation is not a problem. But again, even if the poskim are machmer on that, we would definitely not have to take out a new Sefer Torah if you find a Sefer Torah that has a flat shin. The middle regal of the shin could be disconnected, which again, you'd not have to take out a new Sefer Torah for, but should definitely be fixed after Shabbos. There were places in Yemen where they actually wrote a shin l'chatchila this way based on what's presumably the sheet of the Rambam, that there is no doubt that the whole letter has to be connected in one piece of ink, and this would be perfectly fine. Oh, just to jump back for a second to the connected kuf, I neglected to mention last time what happens when you find a connected hay. A connected hay is even worse than a connected kuf, because even though it's potentially subject in theory to the same rule about being connected versus disconnected, it used to be in the olden days that the difference between a hey and a ches was basically like this. That this was a ches, and this was a hey. Very slight difference. So the hey was not necessarily disconnected from the top. But nowadays, if you show a tinok, or anyone who doesn't happen to know this piece of history, what this is, what are they going to say? They're going to say this is a ches. So therefore, even if you find a hey that's connected, and it's still clearly to you who knows this history, it's clearly still looks like a hay, right? I would call this a hay. I know most of you probably wouldn't, but I would call this a hay. But nevertheless, most people read it as a ches, so therefore it's a much more serious halachic shaila. Could very well be that if you found such a thing in the Sefer Torah on Shabbos, you would need to put it back. Unless it was like only unless this was so tiny here, it was barely noticeable. The connection, and maybe even a tino could read it as a hey, which is somewhat unlikely, but again, you have serious questions if you find a hey that's connected much more than if you find a kuf that's connected. And the same thing, if you find a ches that's disconnected, so it's gonna, even though if you had this in the olden days, maybe people would still read that as a ches. Nowadays, people might read that as a hey, so that you're gonna have more questions based on that. Yeah? One question? Yeah?
So is it like the letters have an objective form, but that, so they think that in reality really is a hey, but because, why would that be?
I don't know. Look in this, there's an excellent sefer on these types of questions called Paschegen Aksav, which is one of the more random things I actually have at the Sfarim sale. But one of the most lamdish Sfarim on Surah Associates is called Paschegen Aksav. He's going to discuss all these things.
But in terms of, if you just, aside from the sefer, so she didn't say it's both toes.
Yeah.
A handy sefer for them.
Paschegen Aksav is not handy.
Right.
Long essays on every prat of every letter.
Anything else that's handy?
Mishnah Berurah with, like you said, the deer shoe is very good. There's one with pictures. There's another one with pictures. What's it called? Per Alacha, I think. Again, the pictures are not always correct. That's really what the Mishnah Berurah means, or what's that the earlier sources that the Mishnah Berurah quotes. What they really mean is sometimes somewhat questionable, but just as a basic start to get used to the more of the details of Tzuras Osios, so then these are all good places to start. Another sefer called Tmunas Osios, which discusses a little bit about the history, about how these things change, like the Kuf, like I was talking about. You can go to the library, there's a whole section on it. And the Tor Beis Yosef Simen Lamedvav.
Tough.
Tough is our final letter, and we will conclude with that. I'll give you my contact information after the Tough. So the main issue with the Tough is that it could be disconnected, and potentially it looked like a hay. If it doesn't have enough of a protrusion over here, and it's just, this thing is very tiny, the little foot is very small, then it could look like a ches, and all these things would be subject to a shailas tinok. And that's pretty much it for the Tzuras Osios. Let me give you my contact information, and if you have any other questions, I'll take them after that. So I have a special email for Sophrus-related inquiries. It's pretty easy to remember, hoffmansofer@gmail.com. I'll give you my phone number if you want. You can text me, call me, whatever.
Can you send me pictures with that also?
Sure, you can send me pictures. I can't always tell by a picture, but... you can take down that information. I'm happy, you know, to assist you now if you need anything, or when you're big rabbanim one day with lots of balbatim who have questions about Sophrus, feel free always to contact me. I'm happy, really happy to assist.